ॐ भद्रं करने दिश्रियाम देवाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षभिर्यजत्राः चिरैरङ्गैः सुशुभागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नः सारक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्तथातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
In this book, it is Vivekta Deshe, it's number 7. What is it for you, all of you, Vivekta Deshe? Problems, different numbers in every. Oh, yeah, on page 74 in this little book, it's Vivekta Deshe, is that what you said?
This is 88.
88, mm-hmm. Okay. Vivekta-deshe chasukasanastah Vivekta-deshe chasukasanastah Suchisamakrivashirashariraha Suchisamakrivashirashariraha Atyashramastas sakalendriyani Atyashramastas sakalendriyani Nirujya bhaktya swagurum pranamya Nirujya bhaktya swagurum pranamya. Okay, that's where this book stops. I think you might have a couple of more lines on there. Do you have two more lines?
No.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Vivekta deshe. So vivekta deshe cha sukha asanastaha shuchihi sama griva shiras shariraha. I think it's on page 88. Diana?
Okay.
Atyashramastaha sakala indriyani nirujya bhaktya swagurum pranamya. Okay. This verse is on, and the verse following, this first verse is on meditation. That's why, remember I said last week that I'm going to go through very kind of thoroughly all of the different, the whole process of developing a meditative mind. All of the different tools that we have at our disposal. I'm going to go through every single one of them, and you might find that not all of them are as useful as others, but you should know about them and understand why we do it that way, how they can be helpful. That's what we're doing. So here, let's look at this verse. Vivekta deshe. Vivekta deshe is a place where you are alone. So deshe means a place. A place where you can be alone, a quiet place where you're not going to be disturbed by others. And there, that not being disturbed by others, it's like if you're sitting like this, you're sitting in meditation, your eyes are closed and you're relaxed, and you know that anybody could walk in at any minute, And so because of that, you can't just have that kind of abandonment. So you have a little hypervigilance because you can be disturbed, and you don't really want somebody to walk in on you when you're sitting there in a meditative pose. It's private, right? And so you want to be able to find that type of space where you can trust that you will be alone for a certain period of time. And that allows you to really give up any tension in the mind and in the body. So you want that secluded, quiet place where you can feel that you're not going to be interrupted. And when Swami Vidhitamananda is talking about this in his book, and he says, that's a big problem in India because there can be so many people in the house. There is no quiet place like that. She says, well, you have to get up before everybody else. Yeah. Or anybody else. Mm-hmm. That's the only way. Because there isn't. And often in some Indian homes, there isn't a quiet place. There's not even a little corner anywhere. And so he was just acknowledging that. But for most of us, there is a quiet place. There is a quiet time. There's a room that you can close yourself off in, into, you know. And so that's the Vivekadesha. In a quiet place, a secluded place where you can be to yourself. You can be alone. Then, so that's first. Then, Sukha Asana Staha. Staha means being able to be placed in on a comfortable asana. So the asana is twofold. One is the actual physical cushion or seat or stanam that you're actually seated on. Is it something comfortable or is it uncomfortable? It should be something comfortable that will support your body, that will support your knees and legs and allow you to completely relax on the physical plane. And then physical plane means external to the body. But then also the asana is your own posture. Can you hold the posture comfortably? And they say you should be able to hold a comfortable posture for 48 minutes. And Vivekatmananda talks about that. Swamiji talked often about that. And that's called like an asana siddhi. That's an accomplishment to action. Sometimes you really have to work for that to be able to hold a position where you can actually sit completely relaxed for more than 2 or 3 minutes. You know, for 45 minutes where you can completely relax, your body is balanced, as we'll see in the next one, your body is balanced, a couple from here, your body is balanced so that the muscles can relax and the body won't topple over. I like that. So the asana is important. For most of us in the West, you probably need to sit. Unless you've worked on creating a good posture, you need to have some sort of support, like sit in a chair or have a backrest or something. Because most people can't; they don't have a strong enough back. Their legs don't go down and hit the floor and give you a solid base. So you have to work for that, or else sit in a chair, you know, something that will support you. Because if you don't do that, your mind is going to be drawn toward your posture, right? Toward your cramps in your legs, etc. So that asana siddhi. Siddhi means the accomplishing. Mastery of an asana is considered very, very important. They also say that in meditation you shouldn't walk around, even though you shouldn't meditate while you're walking. Even though you can have a walking meditation. But again, if you're walking, then that requires the presence of your mind, the operation of your mind. It's not that we can't, there are such things as open-eyed meditation and all of that. But if you're wanting to really relax and resolve your mind, right, if you're having to function out here, then that will work against you. So some people say that. And also they say, Swamiji often said, don't lie down when you're meditating. Because that's the because the mind just thinks sleep. You lie down, you shut your eyes, you know, make your mind go quiet. What does that mean? It means it's time to go to sleep. So that sukhasana, sukha means something which is pleasurable, comfortable. That's what sukha, this word sukha. So sukhasana. A comfortable position and a comfortable platform, comfortable position where your body doesn't have to it doesn't have to work to support you, and your mind is free to let go. So that's the sukhanasa. So it says Vivekadesha in a solitary place, having a comfortable asana, and then I'll skip Suchihi and do this next one. Sama griva shira sharira. Sharira means the body. Griva means the neck. Shira means the head. Sama means like in a straight line. They're all the same. Here's the head. Here's the neck. Here's the body. Okay? So I'll just use this example. So say you have the torso. The spine should be straight, right? And then if the neck's not straight on top of the spine, okay, so here's your spine, here's the neck, okay? Now if it, the neck's like that, say if it's not, or like that, because often the neck will go forward if it's like that, now put the head on top of that. And if the head is on top of a neck which is not straight on top of the spine, there's a tremendous amount of muscle tension to hold up that head. He likens the head to a bowling ball. If you put a bowling ball on top of a stick, right, say you've got a pole, you put the bowling ball on top of it, should be able to rest on top of it, right? If the bowling ball is going to fall off, to keep it from falling, you know, it would require a lot of muscle for that, a lot of tension. And so you have to have your spine, your neck, and your head erect, in a sense, so that the muscles don't have to work. Otherwise the muscles will be taut. So here it says, sama means keeping it the same, briva the neck, shiras the head, sharira the body. So that's part of that sukhasana, right? Okay, then. Next one, shuchihi. Shuchihi means that which is clean. So the cleansing, something is clean, it's pure. So we take it both bahya, externally and internally. We've been working on the internal. External means that the asana that you have, the place that you are, it should be clean, it should be nice, it should be fresh. And that place where you're doing your meditation, it should be pure, clean, just clean, sattvic. You know? But internally also, the mind needs to be clean, it needs to be pure. And so this is the, when we're working to get this meditative to bring the mind into a meditative space, this suchihi is what we're working on. So, because suchihi means, okay, for instance, in terms of what we were just doing, if I come in and I sit down, right, and I just close my eyes, probably initially my mind's going to have bringing a lot of stuff with it. That's not suchihi. It's about bringing all kinds of stuff into the room, all kinds of baggage into the room. So just being able to give it an environment, just to let it think it through, just for a few moments, to let it like run in the meadow, that's one level. You're getting one level of, removing one level of clutter. Just simply letting them, giving the mind a few minutes to think about, to relax, to let go of what it brought into the room. Next level, and all of this is with immediately invoking the inner friend. Because if we sit down and there's a critic inside, then instead of suchihi, there's just going, instead of this kind of purity or cleanliness, there's just going to be more agitation. Because if there's instead of an inner friend, like there's an inner enemy or an inner critic, then that inner critic is going to cause reaction. Right? Just like it does in the world. If I come in and I want to relax and there's a critic there, somebody critical of me there, then the last thing I can do is relax. So it's finished before I start. So that's, right? It's like it's over before you even sit down. No, I'm fine. It's over before you sit down. Right? And so one of the first things we do, you just get used to kind of invoking that part of you that cares about you. Right? And that allows for relaxation. Then you let the mind just wander for a little bit. You know, in just to release some of the clutter you've brought in. Then asking the mind, what do you have to do? What's on your mind? What do you have to do? Just the conscious mind. It probably has all kinds of worries. You know, I have to do this, I have to do that. Or as soon as I leave here, I've got to do this, this, and this tomorrow. I hope I don't forget to do that. you just make the list. You let the mind make the list. That relieves some tension, right? So that gets rid of some more clutter. Now, we're still on a pretty superficial level. In fact, everything we did tonight, it's not superficial exactly, but it's... let me just get into it. That will relieve some of the worry or tension just for the mind that's concerned with business things that it has to get done. You can leave that alone for the time being. Then what we do is address the unconscious. Does anybody inside have anything to say? Going into a relationship with the unconscious. This is really... Once I start doing this, I'm opening up my psyche for... I'm opening it up to a different way of being than I would ever have if I don't do that. If I do that, the unconscious, which normally has a divide between myself and the conscious mind, it's like a defense system, a divide, that keeps that unconscious separate from me. And the result of that keeping it shut off or separate from me is that I have an agitation underneath which I'm not aware of. It's like static. It's like having I can have a quiet mind, but underneath that quiet mind is static. So one of the experiences I'll have of that is, say if I am, my mind is quiet and I try to meditate and absorb my mind, for instance. I want to absorb my mind. And I have some deep meditative experience. I'll sit there, and my mind will be quiet, and that's all it will be. There's no absorption. There's no feeling of depth, no feeling of ananda, no feeling of fullness. There's just a quiet wall. It's like there's a quiet, conscious... The conscious, I have a quiet conscious mind that doesn't have access to any deeper levels of holding it. Deeper levels holding it. But once I address that unconscious, what happens is that mind that can have stress and tension behind the conscious mind, you know, where there's a defense system, the minute I address it, there's like a door has opened between my conscious mind and my unconscious. So if I say to my unconscious, it will hear you. Jung will say, you know, that the unconscious hears everything you say. Right? And it will respond. If you ask it a question in sincerity, it will answer you, you know. And so if you say to your unconscious, does anyone inside have anything to say, it will... more often than not, actually start talking to you. You know, and tell you all kinds of things, you know, about things that are bothering you, things that are hurting it, things that hurt, things that bother you, things that are concerning it. And a lot of times it has to do with all of the different ways you don't feel loved. Because those are the things that are in the unconscious. All of the things that you're comfortable with are in the conscious mind. You know, those are all your memories. You have access to them, all the wonderful things that have happened to you, all the great things people have said to you, and this and that and this. That's all in the conscious mind. But the things that have really bothered you or hurt you, or the areas where you feel insecure, the areas where you feel inadequate or not properly cared for, properly loved or worried, all of these type of things, those are all unconscious material. You know, if they happen when you're an adult, that's very unpleasant, we deal with it, we have to work on that too, that's a whole other layer. You know, but this unconscious, all of these hurts inside are there. If you don't go in and be with them as an inner friend, somebody who cares and wants to hear that whole story and understand the whole thing, then what happens is all of those parts that are hurt or feeling betrayed, they're hurt or they feel betrayed or unloved or unworthy in this way or that way or this way or that way, there, all of those feelings are sitting in there, you know, behind this defensive wall, which God made us that way, very nice, so that we don't have to deal with it all the time. You know, all of these things that we gathered in childhood, and so they're all there. But they're all there inside behind the wall. But the problem is this. When you're meditating, right, and you're making your mind quiet, and you're wanting to deeply relax the mind so that the very self, the very conscious being which is yourself, is what is, the focal point, what happens is when you relax this mind, what becomes the focal point, or can become the focal point, is either the staticky wall, because the unconscious doesn't trust to let you in, and so instead of kind of resolving into the depths of your own being, you resolve into the staticky wall, which is very boring. And then you just say, okay, now what? It's boring because it's just static, no sense of depth or wholeness or anything. Now, say you are go beyond the staticky wall, then what can be there you can get in contact with, especially if the unconscious trusts you and you say, you know, I want to be with you. I want you to tell me whatever you have to say. Then what will happen is that you'll get waves and layers of hurt feelings and all kinds of things. And it's a huge release and relief. And the only way those deeply hurt parts of yourself will come to the surface is if the one who's saying, is there anybody inside that has anything to tell me, that one has to be an inner friend. As I was describing in the meditation, it has to be an inner friend. Because otherwise, the answer will be, no, I'm not here. I'm not here, I have nothing to say. I'm so not here and I have so nothing to say that I'm not even going to say that. Right? I won't even say that. I won't say anything. I won't say anything to you. But the feeling is there. That feeling is there. You know? And so, now, the thing is just like if you can imagine say if you were to have a child, your own child, that child will respond to your love. The child is hurt, you know, if the child is hurt, his feelings were hurt, anything could happen, you know. If you're patient and there and love your child, you know, and wait it out, that child will tell you everything, you know, because it's safe. It has to feel safe. It has to feel that you respect it. You respect the child. You care about the child. You give the benefit of the doubt to the child. You think he's wonderful or she's a wonderful. She's a wonderful little girl. You're a wonderful little girl. You're a wonderful little boy. I know you always do your best. You know? If you fall down, you just get up again. It's okay. You know? That type of open love, you know? Then that child will be fine. It'll get over it. But if the parent is critical, doesn't give the benefit of the doubt, you know, doesn't think the child is good, you know, thinks it's a, you know, spoiled little brat, that's not going to work. Right? There's no healing that takes place. But if you're that way with your child, it will work it out and be fine. The same inside. If you have that love and respect, you know, and care and give the benefit of the doubt and to your own goodness. Those parts that have been trapped in the unconscious can rejoin your conscious ego. That's what happens. They'll rejoin slowly. They'll give up their stress and they'll feel so grateful. So you have to keep working with the unconscious like that, so that all of these parts are released. You know, otherwise they're being held inside. And you'll find that as you play with this, work with it, you get much, much more space inside. You have much more room in your psyche. It airs out, you know. And the wall between the conscious mind and the unconscious becomes very porous. And so then actually you can access even deeper levels of the unconscious. Because if you think that when Carl Jung, who's a psychologist in my own practice I follow, he makes a drawing like this. Say, here's the ocean top of the waves. Then imagine a great big iceberg in the form like this of a pyramid. And sticking right out on the top of this ocean is this little tiny tip of the iceberg. And here's the iceberg. That little tip is the conscious mind. And the rest of it is the unconscious. Right? So he'll talk about it like this, is that all of your perceptions, now we're looking at lifetimes also, Vedanta, we're looking at lifetimes, not just one lifetime. All of your perceptions, all of your experiences are flowing in through your senses. But your conscious mind can only absorb the smallest amount, right? Because otherwise we'd just be totally overwhelmed. But all of that's in there, right? And so there's depths and depths and depths of knowledge. And then also, in terms of the whole universe, all of that's interconnected also with Hiranyagarbha and with the subtle, total manifest subtle Upadhi. So there's a huge, huge reservoir of experience, you know, which you're only enjoying the slightest little tip of. So when this little tip of the conscious mind starts being open to the unconscious, initially you're just going to be open to all of the complexes that are lying right under the unconscious mind, you know. But then after, which is fine, it's a huge relief just to get rid of those, you know, create an environment in which they can grow, they can heal and grow. And then you feel you feel your own conscious mind much more deeply connected to your psyche and your psyche to the universe, because all of these complexes have been brought into conscious relationship so that they can grow. So this is all part of that suchi. We've only looked at two aspects of it. One, when there's evoking the inner friend, is the given. Yes, let's start there. You know, and that invoking the inner friend, once you do that in that meditative posture, it becomes something natural. I mean, why wouldn't you be treating yourself like that all the time? Why just in meditation? Why isn't that just a natural way to treat yourself? And why isn't that the natural way to treat others also? So that inner friend stance becomes a value, because the other is cruel. There's nothing to be gained by it for anybody, internally or externally. It just, you know, the world meets you, as Jung will say, you know, the face you give it. The world is the face it gives back to you. And the face that you give your unconscious is the face it gives back to you. And so you become less and less, you know, isolated. And that brings about a certain relaxation and a certain suchi, a certain ananda, you know. And we like ananda. There isn't, you know, that's what we like. We like to have a mind that has fullness or sense of well-being. And so as we learn to kind of have that inner friend attitude as opposed to an inner critic, there's a reward. You know, there's a big reward. You know, and we gravitate toward that reward. It's just, it's so simple. It's just like, say you go into somebody's home, and in one of the rooms, you know, in the living room, sitting in the living room is the critic, and then sitting in the family room, you know, is the friend. Which room do we go in? You know, that's right. That's how it is. Now, what makes it so interesting is, what if in your room, the room of your psyche, is the critic? Then where are you going to go? Well, you're going out here and out here and out here and out here, because you can't, there's no home to go to. There's no, you don't want to go home. Right? You don't want to go home. Whereas what if sitting in the room of your psyche is your dearest friend? Is your dearest friend? Then you love to be home. You love to be home, and then no matter where you are, you're home. You're here, but you're home. If the inner critic is inside, then you're here, but you're not home. Right? Because it's no good to be home, and so you're like a vagabond, you know, landing here, landing here, landing here, landing here, because the last place you want to land is home. Where if that inner friend is there, you say your closest, your dearest friend, the one who loves you, the one who cares, then staying home, you're here and here and here, there's no vagabond. So that's why that's the evoking this inner friend is so important. So that's what's really key. We're going to, next week, because I'm going to not do all of this at once. Next week we'll look at different levels of evoking this inner friend and different ways of doing that. But for now, you should remember these. This is what we've done so far. Evoking the inner friend in terms of feeling thankful and grateful for even having a body and mind and sense organs. It's a miracle to have this. It's something absolutely amazing, and to appreciate it, you know, that will allow your body, your physical body, to relax. It'll allow the mind to relax. Then having that attitude of real friendship, you know, toward the body, but especially toward the body, but especially toward the mind, you know. And then letting the mind tell you what it has to do for the day, letting the mind, evoking the unconscious, and letting it talk to you. You know, some people, up to that point of just evoking the unconscious and letting the unconscious tell you whatever it has to say, dialogue with it, that's all the farther they get in meditation for quite some time. And I would say, if you are able to evoke the unconscious and ask it anything, and if a lot of people are raising their hand, then just do that for a while. You know, just do it so that all of that airs out. You know, be patient, you know, and do it every day. Every day until that becomes natural to you. Because just like invoking the inner friend is natural, can be very, very natural, that open relationship with the unconscious becomes very natural. Like, for instance, if you have a feeling comes up, instead of just ignoring it or looking out at who is causing the feeling, you go to the feeling itself. You get used to that, going into dialogue with all of the different parts inside, and then you say, oh, what's that? You know, what are you feeling? You ask yourself, what are you feeling? What's that about? Let it talk. And you'll find that the unconscious starts becoming very responsive to you, and it becomes very responsive on deeper and deeper levels, so that you You sense things, you know things, and you pay attention. That brings about good health in the psyche, and what we call that suchi. Later on, next week, we'll work on that suchi in terms of my likes and dislikes. For instance, you'll go through the environment, and there's this person that's really bothersome, and this person I don't like, and this person's wrecking my life. We have to deal with those. That level of suchi, too. But for now, just keep it at this, okay? Okay, then, next thing, atyashramastaha. The person who is sitting in meditation, their stance, they should be rooted in that final ashrama, which is the sannyasa ashrama. The sannyasi is the one who takes the orange, right? But here, they're talking about meditation. You don't have to be a sannyasi to take, you don't have to have taken the orange to meditate. But when you're contemplating, you know, what you want to do is to bring your mind into that state of vairagya. It's a state of vairagya. I'll get into this. We'll be doing a lot of this over these verses. What vairagya means, it translates as dispassion. But by dispassion, what it really is, for some of you who have self-knowledge, is that my ananda, or my sense of wholeness, that all is well with me, right? That sense of wholeness, is not dependent upon anything in the world. In fact, the whole universe can go away. And that wholeness is the very nature of my being. And so what we do really in meditation is own up after we go through all of the suchi stuff, right? Making the mind, bringing the mind into a meditative state. When we bring the mind into a meditative state, what we recognize is that the source of the ananda, or the source of what, the source of ananda that makes me into a whole and complete being, is me, is the very nature of the self. And it's that recognition that allows for vairagya. There is no vairagya or dispassion as long as I think I need this to be happy. If I think I need this to be happy, then there's no dispassion toward that, because I have to be happy. Right? And so to the degree that I superimpose my well-being onto the creation, I need that. But when I'm in contemplation, because for in Vedanta, contemplation requires knowledge. You can't contemplate without knowledge. Right? Contemplation helps you to own up your knowledge. So here, when you're contemplating, what you recognize at the time of contemplation is that the ananda that I seek, the wholeness that I seek, I am. And that is a state of sannyasa. If I can say, I am what I seek, then I can accept the world as it is. It's not required to make me full. And so I evoke at the time of meditation that state of sannyasi. If I'm not living the life of a sannyasi, see, the problem is, even if I'm wearing the orange and I'm taking to the life of sannyasa, I still have to evoke the reality of that sannyasa. So here at the time of meditation, I evoke the reality of my own nature as being the ananda that I seek. When I evoke that reality, it means I'm sitting in that ananda. I am that ananda. I am that wholeness. And then I revel in that wholeness. That's the state of sannyasa. In fact, the only one that is really a sannyasi is the one who's a jnani. The other person, we take sannyasa, it's called vividisha sannyasa. You take sannyasa so that you can know, so that you can live out the lifestyle that can allow you to gain this knowledge. Vividisha means the sannyasa with a desire to know. I take sannyasa with a desire to know myself. That's vividisha sannyasa. The vidvat sannyasa is the one who does know. I do know myself, and my mind abides in that self. That's the vidvat sannyasi. called Sarva Karma Sannyasa. I renounce all karma, only in the sense that my being is free from karma. My being is free from doing, you know. My being is full without doing. It doesn't require any doing. And so I sit in the reality of that. And so in meditation, I evoke that state of sannyasa. And sakala indriyani niruddha. Having controlled all of my sense organs. That's where we get the body into a comfortable position. I shut down my sense organs and live in a quiet space. I make my body relaxed so that my muscles, my sense of touch isn't being put in pain by muscle cramps. I'm in a quiet space. My eyes are shut, you know, and then I work with my mind to make the mind become quiet also, partly by just letting the mind think for a few minutes, giving it a few minutes to think, asking it what it needs to do, evoking the unconscious just to unwind the mind so that it also can be quiet, right? I withdraw the sense organs, I unwind the mind, do all of this inner work to give the mind, to relax the mind, so that the mind and the sense organs have become withdrawn and resolved. And then having done all that, then what finally? Bhakja Svabhudum Pranamya. For those who have a guru, with devotion, I do salutations to my teacher. And the reason for that, in India, the guru-sisha relationship is very sacred. It's like the guru is actually a form of, for you, for in the tradition, it's an Ishwara. You know, it's just like you might do your pranams to Rama or Krishna. Often the teacher will also be like treated internally like the Ishtadevata. And the reason is for a teacher who's a Shrotriya Brahmanishtha, right, they are, if the teacher is mature, they are the inner friend personified. Just like, you know, if you were to evoke Rama or Ganesha or your Ishtadevata, hopefully they are the inner friend personified. You know, somebody who truly loves you, truly, truly cares, truly wants the best for you, truly thinks you're a great person. you're a great person, and if there's some little problem, that's incidental, and he'll just help you with that. Mm. You know, that's your teacher, it's like that. You know, I always think of Swamiji, because Swamiji is like that for me, so much like that. And so that's like an Ishtadevata, you know, because they're inner friend personified, and they've given you this knowledge, you know, and there's no really, with this knowledge, that channel between the guru sisha, when this knowledge is taking place, it's like there's just a love opening, because the ananda, you know, the teacher is ananda and is making you recognize yourself as ananda, you know, and so it's just ananda. There's no greater love than that. There you go, it's from love to love. Right? And so it's a very, very sacred relationship. And so because of that, when you're contemplating, you can evoke your Ishtadevata, you evoke the Lord, really in the form of your guru, because if your teacher invokes the personification of that inner friend, say. Really, when we think of the inner friends, you know, who you're evoking is your very best self. You know, you're evoking the Swami in you. You know, you're evoking that person who truly, truly cares. And in the outside world, you have glimpses of that with people. Everybody's experienced it, but, you know, with your guru, it's you continually experience it, I would say. You know, you can trust it. Not that the guru is is perfect in Vyavahara, and nobody's perfect in empirical reality, but there's a depth of trust there. You can count on it. And so that's why I say, if here with bhakti you do your namaskar, your pranams to your teacher, it is a way of evoking. See, just by doing that, you're evoking automatically that inner friend. And so you can kind of understand the dynamics of that. If you don't have a teacher that you can do it in with just because of your own experience with that inner friend in yourself and from others, you can evoke that in yourself. You know, you can evoke that. And you can learn to count on it. You don't have to evoke a guru for that. You don't have to, really, you don't have to evoke the Lord for that. You can evoke it because it's there in you, right? And so it doesn't really matter. Whatever it takes to evoke that, if it's, for some people, it's easy to do it in terms of evoking their Ishtadevata, that's a form of the Lord that they have a relationship with. You know, it's called, in India, it's called Ishtadevata, or you evoke it in terms of the guru, or you evoke it in terms of your own experience of love and friendship that you've shown toward others or others have shown towards you. You learn how to do that. When you do that, the mind is taking on a shantavritti. It's taking on a level of warmth and purity that will become natural to you, to your mind, after some time, after it's worked out all of these complexes and pain-producing things that we need to work through. And so it's just, I mean, I think this is such an ancient text, and they know all of this. They have their own ways of doing it, you know, of evoking that type of inner space that can allow the mind to grow and develop. So here, this is the Viruja Bhaktya, Sukhadun Pranamya. So now, having all done all of this, it's now going, and we'll do this next week, going to go into having created this meditative space in your mind. That's all we've done now. All we're working on now is getting that meditative space. Now what do we do with it? Now that your mind has got some peace and relaxation, now we have to turn it toward, you know, the nature of the self. And so there's a whole list of words, but each one of these words is an unfoldment as to what the very nature of the self is. So it would be nice to go through all of the words, but let's stop there.
That's good.
Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harih Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harih Om.
Even while you were teaching and unfolding that verse, my mind became so happy.
That's good.
Yeah, so I thank you for that.
That's what we want to take in mind. It seems so obvious, you know, when you say it, that of course the mind, like the whole world, responds to love. you know, and respect. Of course it would. But we don't realize that we don't give it to ourselves, basically. Mm-hmm. We expect it to come from the outside, but then we don't notice how what our own self-talk is. What is the self-talk like? Is it loving and respectful? Is are you your best friend? Are you your own best friend? Mm-hmm. Even in the Gita, Krishna says, you know, you can be your worst enemy or your best friend. But we don't tend to notice that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was even like last week in the meditation you were talking about to appreciate the senses and the body and how much they appreciate being appreciated. And that was a release too, you know what I mean?
That's true, they appreciate being appreciated. Just like you appreciate from the outside. Yeah. If somebody appreciates you, you feel embarrassed and everything because if it tickles.
But you know, the truth of it rang in me because I'd never appreciated my eyes like that, and then my eyes kind of felt grateful that somebody was paying attention to them in the proper way. You know?
That's true. That's right. Mm-hmm. Body responds. Mind responds.
But I think that's a very unusual phenomenon for that body to be responding, and the sense organs responding.
Well, the thing is it isn't unusual, but we don't know it until you know it. The body does respond. Everything responds.
Yeah.
But we don't tend to think about it, or we don't tend to think about it. That's why when it's said or you do it, it of course. But we don't think about it, so
we don't
use it.
Yeah.
You know, don't act on it.
Just like the thoughts and sensations aren't, you know, we're not, as far as conditioning or whatever, that they're actually external to ourselves, you know, that they're arriving within or outside in that way to be able to even have a relationship with it as not self, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's something that's like, oh, well, of course, like you're saying, but it's also not, you know, everything that to be a jiva, to be conditioned in this world, is that that's you and you're, you know, that represents you, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's like
so we don't think of being with it.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
No, it's very crazy.
It's strange. It's like they have a life of their own, like a kitten or somebody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you love the little kitten, the more she responds.
Mm.
The sense organs. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. That's true.
Anyway, I was overwhelmed by that idea. You know, it was very overwhelming.
Good.
She comes your way, that might say.
No, it's like a child that's like that's you know, that feels like they did something wrong or whatever. You know, it's there's a great relief in the no, it's okay. You know,
yeah.
No, it's really, really okay. No, it's really, it's okay. You're all right. It's okay. You know,
Exactly. Yeah.
That's not, I mean, it's super useful stuff, and it's not stuff that I used to hearing in sort of spiritual circles. You know, at least the ones I've been running in, I guess. There's a focus on a lot of absolute and a lot of philosophy, and then like the sort of, you know, the place for working on, you know, the psychology, essentially, of yourself is really useful. Instead of just like, no, I don't deal with that, you know.
Yeah, it's because that doesn't really work.
Right.
You know, because the rest of it's all in there saying, oh, what about me? What about me? You know?
Yeah, right.
And so that meditative space won't be there without doing these things.
Yeah. Well, unless you go there, you can be stuck your whole life with that crowd in there.
Yeah.
It's not cared for.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, stuck.
Mm-hmm. know, it's there. It's in the scriptures, and Swamiji does a lot. He does a lot with it. I'm going to do all the different things he does.
Okay.
Some are really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
There's different ways of taking care of the reactions and things we have in the mind, that then if they're there when you're trying to contemplate, let alone trying to live. It's nice to kind of know how to be with those things so that they can not torment you.
As I sort of been able to integrate more and more of this teaching, that there have been times where I'm like, wow, okay, I'm really making a lot of sense here, I'm feeling really stable, and I'll notice, I'll be like, okay, bring it, you know, and then it comes, you know,
yeah.
it's like okay, you know, there's always, it's you know, the more tools we have to be able to create space and to work with, you know, the things that come up, I think the more that they come up, you know.
Well, you know what, that's exactly right. The more you develop those tools or ways of being with those problems, they come up in layers. First, this layer will come.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but and now you're stronger,
mm-hmm.
so this layer can come.
Right.
And
yeah.
That's and works its way through that way.
Yeah. So is it? Would you suggest that there's an end to the layers?
Uh-huh.
There is. It's not just that you become the attitude, and then so it doesn't matter how many layers come. Or
no, I would say like this. Both are true.
Uh-huh.
It's like, as that attitude becomes natural to you, and also that attitude really is natural to yourself. So yourself, actually, the nature of the self feels the attitude, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so there comes a time when all you need there is yourself, because you are the attitude,
right.
Like that. Mm-hmm. But so that becomes really natural to be able to handle whatever comes up.
Mm-hmm.
But since the psyche is almost limitless in nature, there's never going to be an end to the surprises,
right.
But there is an end, I'd say, to the major knots
mm-hmm.
in the psyche,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
the ones that are really kind of
disturbing, yeah, painful,
painful, and kind of keeping you like they're like bondages,
right?
You know,
clouds to your vision or whatever.
Yeah,
you really can't.
So those there comes a time when you've hit the bottom of the bucket. And that doesn't mean that there aren't going to still be stuff to work on.
Sure.
But these layers upon layers, you get down to the bottom, and then one goes and you feel, you know, that's really it in terms of these big things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then you don't feel, you don't get constricted.
Yeah. Your psyche doesn't feel constricted. And then we still, there's always so many things to work on. What it comes down to is after the big bad complexes are, the baddies are gone, you know, or you've been released from those. But then there's the vairagya.
Mm-hmm.
Vairagya means the tentacles of the psyche into the every aspect of my world, and every aspect of my own mind, and everything that somehow it needs to be this way for me to be happy, or this needs to be such. There's just like almost like an endless letting go.
Hmm.
That's a slower, at least in my life, that's an ongoing letting go.
Hmm.
Ongoing letting go, and it's a maturing process.
Mm-hmm.
But that maturing process isn't, you don't feel encumbered by it,
right.
As you do by these layers and layers of painful conflict.
Well, it's kind of like you have to be on guard, you know.
Well, with the vairagya, you just realize what it means to be a really mature person is, it's an outstanding thing. That maturation process where you really, really, really are not asking anything of the creation.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's really very beautiful. You know, it's pleasing to watch yourself develop, but there's a lot of developing. It's a lot of ongoing maturing, you know.
Well, the face of the unconscious facing towards the world. Sometimes I notice like that's happening without me even noticing, and all of a sudden I go like, why am I seeing all this stuff going on all of a sudden, you know? It's because like this unconscious projecting, and it hasn't been conscious yet.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The unconscious projects until you become conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see it outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then you respond to it outside.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Until you become conscious of an unconscious process, I mean, everybody else will be conscious of it in you. That's how it is, you know.
Yeah.
You see everybody else's shadow, but you don't see your own. As long as it's in the unconscious, right, you don't see it. Others will see it, but you don't see it. You know, and so it projects out, and then you respond to it outside. Then what happens is, as you become conscious of your own stuff, then it's a huge relief to the world because you're not projecting it onto anybody else. You're dealing directly. That's maturation for in Jungian psychology, and that's individuation. That's the process of becoming psychologically mature.
Mm.
You know, and that's also a, you know, kind of a long drawn out process because we're always projecting as long as we have an unconscious, we're projecting it.
What do you mean by projecting? What do you say?
Well, like say, if I'm feeling something inside that I'm unconscious of, then what I'll do is I'll project that onto you and then respond to you. Or actually, it's my feeling. Or it's my concern. But I can't admit it in myself.
Mm.
But I'm feeling it.
Mm.
But I can't admit that it's mine. But since I'm feeling it and I'm seeing you, right, I'll project it onto you, and then I'll respond to that feeling in you. So it gets externalized.
Did I cause it?
Oh, you caused it, or you have it. Like say, I feel unworthy, but I won't of something. I'm unworthy. I'm an unworthy person. That's how I feel, but I'm not going to feel that way. I'm not going to own that.
Yeah.
And so then I look at you, and you think I'm unworthy.
Yeah, you blame me for it.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't blame you for my being unworthy. You think I'm unworthy.
Oh.
I don't think I'm unworthy. I'm feeling unworthy, and that's because you think I'm unworthy.
Yeah.
That I'm feeling unworthy. See, what's interesting here is the feeling of being unworthy is there. But that feeling is coming from you, not from me.
Mm-hmm.
But you feel that I'm unworthy. And who do you think you are?
To think that I'm unworthy. And the tenacious habit of the mind is to go like, no. It's obvious. It's that person in that situation. Look, the facts are there.
That's exactly,
you know?
Right. So exactly. So then what you have to do is once you start understanding all of this stuff, you know, then you say, no matter what you believe, like say you're feeling unworthy and then I look at you and, oh, Edward, you think I'm unworthy. Then you say, no, wait. Just go to the feeling. And then you address the feeling itself. You know, the feeling is, you're feeling unworthy. What is that about? You talk to your unconscious and let it tell you.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes it's hard to get into there, too. I mean, you have to, they require some discipline.
You have to learn how to do it. And then the thing is that what you do is to know that the unconscious is active is when you have a feeling, you know, then talk to the feeling. Don't worry about anything. Don't worry about what's causing the feeling.
Okay.
You just talk to the feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not so hard, other than remembering to do that and getting used to doing that.
I mean, Swami says it's beautiful and very simple, because, like, you know, you might want to consider that you could be wrong. The way he said it, probably non-judgmental.
Yeah.
You could possibly consider that you might be wrong about somebody or some situation.
Yeah. Because, you know, the thing is, it's so tricky because the feeling is real. Right, whatever the feeling is, that feeling is really there.
Yeah,
it's there. Yeah. And so you can't say that, don't tell me I'm not feeling that, I am feeling that. You know, that's real. But what you might be wrong is with the source of it.
Hmm.
You know? And we're convinced, unless we know, understand this, we're convinced that not only do we have to know the feeling, we know the source of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the source is what's projected.
Mm.
The feeling's not projected. The feeling's there. It's being experienced.
Mm.
You know?
Mm.
Does it get, is it something that we've, you know, would you say it can be traced back to a childhood event?
Usually,
and then it gets reinforced over, you know, by projection or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Over time.
Or triggers, right?
And triggers.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Like, and say it would be, it's not like a similar situation in the present can't happen, but the thing is, if it's only in the present, then you'll just deal with it. If the feeling will be proportionate to the present situation.
Mm-hmm.
But the giveaway is when the feeling is way out of proportion to the given situation.
Mm-hmm.
But if the projection is really strong, then of course we'll project a monster onto the person.
Mm-hmm.
The monstrosity of the feeling gets projected onto the person too, you know. So then that person becomes as monstrous as the feeling that they're causing.
That's the unconscious space with them.
Yeah.
And you are unworthy.
That's all, you know, unworthy, inadequate, unloved. These are all painful feelings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, guilt and shame.
Well, what amazes me is they can stick for so long. I mean, say some of these things happen to you when you're nonverbal, you know, and they get imprinted, kind of.
Yeah. Well, they're just in there until you go in and start talking to them and they're coming into relationship, and then that causes, that allows bringing consciousness into it, then starts all that healing.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise they're really locked in the unconscious because there's no air, they're locked in. And they can stay that locked in for your whole life. But
well,
once you
that's
come
not
in,
make-believe, that's a
no, that's
fact.
How it is. But if you come in with that sense of love or friendship, then that's like a good parent. I mean, and then all of those, what in Jungian language we'd say, you know, all those archetypes get, you know, moving again. They're not frozen. And then they can work themselves out.
And of course you're very fortunate if you find a teacher who can mirror that to you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, I've seen a lot of psychologists that mess me up more than anything else. Or gurus.
So these are all steps to develop a meditative state of mind.
That's right.
Then we gotta do something with that.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting too is all of these things we're talking about for meditation are for your life. But we do it in meditation, but it actually becomes just the natural way of being.
Mm-hmm.
And that meditative space is a natural space.
Mm-hmm.
But we use meditation to own that up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you kind of sit yourself, take yourself away, seclude yourself, and allow yourself to just be with that.
Mm-hmm.
So the mind can, in a sense, learn it. Gives it the space to understand.
Practice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then it just becomes the way you are. Where you naturally are.
Yeah. It's almost like those professional football players. They practice and practice and practice for years and then get really good at it.
Mm. There you go. Yeah. Well, like with an instrument, you know, you'll spend time when people aren't listening and you can mess up so that you can try stuff and get used to it so that when you're performing or whatever, you know,
I don't know why it's all
knowledge, you know, this is all knowledge based, but the thing is, is that how we related to the world before you understand is almost the opposite.
Yeah.
And so it takes a while, you know, for your mind to reroute all of these, all of these ways of being.
Well, it's a neuron based, I mean, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's almost like you create a new brain, kind of a new brain.
Everything reroutes itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Based upon your knowledge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually physiological happening then?
It's like a brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, even without knowledge, forget about self-knowledge, as you gain knowledge just growing, or even any type of knowledge, as you gain that knowledge, then everything that you knew before is modified now in reference to that knowledge.
And you have a new track that you...
It's a new... Now you know this, so you view things through that which you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the mind changes.
Mm-hmm. Brain does.
The mind, the brain, the whole thing,
yeah.
you know, mm-hmm. changes in light of new knowledge. That's an ongoing process. But now this knowledge is makes everything, you know, instead of you being an individual in the world, you're the very substratum of the whole universe. And so it's quite opposite.
Right.
And instead of searching for in the world for Ananda, you are the very source of Ananda. And so your mind has been programmed to just by experience. Experientially programmed, not that somebody's programming it, but experientially programmed to seek, you know, fullness or ananda from satisfying desires rather than living from fullness. You're living to achieve fullness.
Just backwards.
Yes, backwards. It's like ulta, in the sense of ulta, opposite. Swamiji will say that everything's ulta.
And then we all laugh.
Yeah,
because we know what ulta means.
Right, that's good. Yeah.
It's all backwards and mixed up.
Mm.
Seems like every class that you give, I enjoy it the most, as opposed to the last class.
That's good.
Yeah, we always leave going, what, that was just the best class? Yeah, I know.
That's
what
we want,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's a good one.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, thank you.